From WBUR Boston, this is Here and Now, a daily digest of news and culture.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Here and Now is a production of PRI and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, Public Radio's daily podcast of news and culture. In his huge new book, The War of the World, historian Neil Ferguson documents what he calls history's bloodiest century, the 20th. 100 years of slaughter sparked by, he says, empires in decline, ethnic disintegration, and economic volatility. He believes these factors come together in an overwhelming deluge of human hatred during an age of unparalleled human progress. He also cautions that these forces are at play today and may shape the history that will eventually be written of the 21st century. Neil Ferguson is professor of history at Harvard, and we wanted to spend some time with him today. He's also a research fellow at Oxford College, and he joins us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington. Neil Ferguson, welcome.
Hello, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine. And first, let's go to your overarching thought, because I can see minds ticking and thinking, oh, really? You know, well, what about? So you say the 20th century, most violent century in history. What about when the Mongols reigned, you know, Genghis Khan?
It's pretty hard to work out these figures for the ancient times. So one has to be cautious here. And remember, World War II looks like one of the biggest man-made calamities of all, with a death toll of around 60 million. There's very few events in human history that can compete. Some earlier events may have led to very high death tolls through indirect means. For example, you have a war and it leads to a famine because agricultural systems are very fragile. But the key point about the 20th century is that most of this violence is intentional, man-made violence, directly and willfully caused. And that means we have something very, very hard to explain. The existence, as I try to argue, of hatred in the midst of progress.
I just want to give some of the numbers that you give. You say by one estimate there were 16 conflicts throughout the 20th century that cost more than a million lives, a further six that claimed between 500,000 and a million, 14 that killed between 250 and 500,000. In all, between 167 million and 188 million people died in the 20th century?
Yes, one really scary statistic is that one in every 22 deaths was a violent death. But of course, some places are way more dangerous than others in the 20th century, and some decades are much more dangerous too. So what I found was very helpful was to ask the question, why was it so dangerous to be born in, say, Ukraine or Poland or Serbia in around 1904? And it was relatively safe to be born, as I was, in Glasgow, in Scotland in 1964.
Well, you came to some conclusions, including that there were three common threads that you believe run through this violent century. And I'm flipping through this huge book now. And I have to say, it's very depressing. Pictures of pogroms in Odessa in 1905, the bodies of dead Armenian children. Here's Greeks fleeing Turkish troops in 1922. There's Hutu, Tutsi, Nazis, Pol Pot, Mao. Tell us a little bit about these three common threads that you find running through all of this violence.
For me, the key things that link together nearly all of these episodes of extreme million-plus violence are, firstly, and this is in some ways the most prosaic of the three, economic volatility. It's when economic life is very bumpy, up and down, very violent swings in activity, that societies seem more likely to descend into conflict. And the most economically volatile time in the 20th century was the interwar period, the 1920s and 1930s, not least because of the Great Depression. But two other things are really critical here. One is ethnic disintegration, by which I mean the breakup and descent into violence of multi-ethnic societies. One of the most striking findings of the book is that the places where conflict was most likely to occur were places like that triangle of territory between the Baltic Sea, the Black Sea, and the Balkans, where an enormous proportion of the violent death of the 20th century occurred, particularly in that time between around 1904 and 1953, which in encapsulated and included the two world wars. And finally, there's the phenomenon of empires in decline. And I argue that it's when empires disintegrate that violence tends to spike, because it's at that point that contests break out at the local level for future power.
Remind us of some of the empires that declined.
It starts off with the Qing dynasty, the Chinese empire, descending into chaos, republic, followed by civil war. Then, of course, there's a great crisis of empire in the First World War, which leaves four empires on the floor in various states of disintegration. The Ottoman Empire, what became modern Turkey, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Romanov-Russian Empire, and the Hohenzollern-Prussian Empire in Germany. And the story then continues with another great crisis of empire in the early 1940s in Asia, when Japan launches a hugely successful war against the Western empires in Asia, the British, French, Dutch, and of course the American Empire in the Philippines. So the story of imperial crisis continues through World War II. After 1945, we have what historians call the era of decolonization, when the West European empires very slowly and painfully broke apart. And finally, towards the end of the century, of course, you have the disintegration of the last great European empire in Eurasia, which was, of course, the Soviet Union. Mm. And at each stage in this process, there are really very substantial spikes in violence. A good example of this is what happens at the end of British rule in India, when partition leads to an enormous outbreak of violence that claimed a million plus lives, as far as one can establish, as Hindus and Muslims fought against one another. It's a classic example of what I was describing earlier, when a multi-ethnic or sectarian society rips itself apart. This is what often produces the most extreme violence, not necessarily conventional warfare, though that plays a vital part in the early 1940s, but often also this horrible process that we sometimes call ethnic cleansing. Entire minorities are driven out of their traditional place of inhabitation, or actually wiped out.
That leads us to some of the myths about violence in the 20th century. When we raised this topic around the office, everyone assumed the reason that it was the most violent century was because the 20th century had the most advanced weapons. You say what?
Well, this is the most popular response. I mean, every time I talk about this, no matter where the lecture hall or the show, this is what people say. And the problem is that it doesn't work, because of course, as the 20th century went on, military technology became exponentially more lethal, particularly after you have the atomic bomb and then the hydrogen bomb. And yet, in fact, there's a tailing off of extreme violence in the later half of the 20th century. What's more, when you look at some of the worst violence of the second half of the 20th century in places like, say, Cambodia or Rwanda, it's carried out with the most primitive weaponry. Machetes, axes, sometimes simply clubs.
And what about the thinking that violence in the 20th century came because there were such evil men that launched it? You know, Hitler, Pol Pot, Stalin. What do you think about that theory that evil came through one person?
Every society has its madmen, its psychopaths. It takes particular conditions for a particular madman to suddenly acquire power. And that's really why I wanted to write the book, because I don't think one can just attribute it all to three really bad guys.
Historian Neil Ferguson, his new book is The War of the World, makes the case that the 20th century was history's bloodiest. We've just been looking back at history. Let's look forward now. Neil Ferguson, you supported the U.S.-led war in Iraq, and I'm going to quote you. You said you argued that if it was to be done, it should be done well or not at all, but you didn't oppose it, and with the benefit of hindsight, you now regret that. Today you say Iraq shows the U.S. empire in decline. And the other factors that came together to cause the violence in the 20th century are now at play in the Middle East. You say it starts with the failed economies there. Explain that.
The degree of volatility of growth in the Middle East in the last 20 years is roughly the same as we experienced in the developed economies in the Great Depression. There's ethnic disintegration going on at a terrifying rate. You read every day about sectarian violence escalating in Iraq, particularly in Baghdad. As Sunnis and Shiites reenact the Balkan Wars, if you like, in a new context. And this is a deeply disturbing possibility because, of course, it could escalate beyond the borders of Iraq. I mean, the entire Middle East potentially could have a sectarian war within Islam in the years to come if the situation isn't brought under control. And, of course, the thing that we might once have relied on to bring the Middle East under control, namely the power of the United States, is manifestly waning. In many ways, I think most informed commentators would agree that Iraq has exposed the limits of American military power. So we have, if you don't mind the term used in this context, an empire in decline right before our very eyes.
Well, some people do mind the phrase, you know, empire in decline. Explain what you mean by that. I mean, it's a fuzzier image of an empire. That it's not as clear as Ottoman, if you will, if you're talking about the U.S. as an empire in decline.
Well, in my last book, Colossus, I tried to make the case that, from a historian's point of view, any state that sends armies into Mesopotamia and Afghanistan on a mission to implant its own style of political institutions is behaving precisely as empires in the past behaved.
Even if they say they're doing it not to occupy, but to withdraw.
Yeah, the trouble is that that's exactly what the British said when they went into Baghdad in 1917. We come not as conquerors, but as liberators. That was the precise terms mm-hmm. of a proclamation issued in 1917. So English-speaking empires always say that they're not really in the business of empire, that they're doing something much more high-minded. The trouble is that's not how it looks to everybody else. And I think the interesting thing about this debate on American empire is that it is a debate only in the United States. In the rest of the world, it's more or less a given that the United States is an imperial power. And when Hugo Chavez says something like that at the United Nations, only Americans are shocked. Everybody else says, well, you know, tell us something new, tell us something interesting. So there's a sense in which if you understand the United States as a peculiar kind of empire, an empire in denial, doesn't really want to admit that it's an empire. It's nevertheless a helpful way of understanding the world we're in, because I think compared with the power the US had in the Middle East, say in the early 1970s, it's clearly much less powerful now to determine policy in states as diverse as Israel and Saudi Arabia, to say nothing of a country that it's actually occupied, Iraq. So although my argument goes against the grain with most American listeners, and I know that from bitter experience, there is a need, to quote the Scottish poet Robert Burns, to see yourselves as others see you. And I think if you recognise that, to put it slightly crudely, you're the redcoats now, an awful lot becomes clear.
And Neil Ferguson, it sounds as if you're saying that the question isn't even whether or not the U.S. should stay or go in Iraq. You're saying that the power has waned and they don't even have the choice. The U.S. forces can't affect the change that's needed in Iraq.
One of the indicators of that is just demographic birth rates, particularly declining birth rates in Europe and very high birth rates in Asia and the Middle East, mean that the West is really a much less important percentage of humanity than it was 100 years ago. In about 20 years, North America and Europe combined will account for barely 14% of the world's population. That's an awful lot less than 100 years ago. And I think you can illustrate this point in Iraq really well. 1920, the British are able to suppress an insurgency in Iraq. And at that time, the ratio of Iraqis to British occupying forces was about 20 to 1. Today, it's 210 to 1. And that's to say there are more than 200 Iraqis for every American soldier and indeed British soldier combined in Iraq. Mm. That's an order of magnitude more Iraqis. And therefore, there was never really much chance that an occupying force as small as 145,000, 150,000 men would be able to maintain order in a country like Iraq. It was wildly optimistic to think it could be done with so few boots on the ground. And I think in that sense, the book has an important implication for the early 21st century. As American structures of international order become weak, we probably should expect international violence to increase. Now, that, of course, is not an argument you will ever hear on the left. The view on the left is always that when empires go, everything gets better. My point in the War of the World is to show that that isn't so, and that very often the end of empire is a time which sees increased violence and usually a diminution of individual freedom.
And I want to rush to point out that many on the left in the U.S. think if we broke it, we need to fix it. You're saying it may not be fixable.
There's really a sense which you can see when you look at the casualty figures that the violence no longer directly concerns the invaders. It's now Iraqi on Iraqi violence, and we're not doing a very good job of stopping that because the body count seems to be higher practically every month. So this is a deeply disturbing phenomenon, and I think it's of a piece with the history that I'm telling, in which the really destructive forces that tear mankind apart aren't clashes between civilizations, but clashes within civilizations. And most people who've died since the end of the Cold War have died in wars between ethnic groups inside a particular civilization, whether it's in the Middle East or in Central Africa. So the prediction that we were going to enter a time of clashing civilizations, Islam against the West, has so far turned out to be wrong. So we need to understand why the more complex structures within civilizations can malfunction, why neighbors, and this is a really important point, can suddenly kill one another on the ground of some, in many ways, superficial religious or cultural or ethnic difference. And I think the War of the World is an attempt to answer that question. What makes a neighborhood implode? Because I think we're seeing it in Baghdad, and we saw it many, many times throughout the 20th century, all over the world, from one end of Eurasia to the other.
Neil Ferguson, he's professor of history at Harvard, a research fellow at Oxford College. His new book is The War of the World, 20th Century Conflict and the Descent of the West. Neil, thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tune in weekdays at noon for live, up-to-the-minute news from around the world, and visit our website, here-now.org, for more on today's top stories. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.